Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Jim Christie. Now, we talked about your fiction before the break, and before we leave fiction, can you tell us briefly about your 20th book? I think that's marvelous. The Redemption of Anne Dupree. Some people felt that this was a complete departure from your previous novels. Do you agree, and if so, why?
It was a complete departure in terms of setting and mood, but it all comes from the same place. And this book is about a 74-year-old woman who was helped to escape from an old age home where she has been railroaded by her daughter and mean son-in-law, and helped by a 29-year-old over-educated, under-experienced social worker. And they go off on a venture to Mexico. She had been an actress and a singer and talks a lot, and quite a contrast in the personalities.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Actually, it sounds like it could be a lot of fun.
I don't think it's bad. Tragic, but funny too.
Good. Okay, so let's switch a little bit now to your poetry. One of your books, Marimba Forever, published with Guernica in 2010. Are there some topics that you think demand to be a poem rather than a story?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you can do either one, I guess, if you're so inclined. You could take a subject like we were talking earlier about what used to be known as Rhodesia. Well, I wrote journalism about that. I could turn it into a novel, but I also wrote a few poems about it. So there's different aspects. I'll tell you one thing, though. Poetry's harder to write. Mm-hmm. If you're applying yourself assiduously, you can get away with stuff in prose, but the poetry, you have to be precise. And I write for sound, so I play with the lines like some people with musicians would go over and over a stanza.
Right.
You know, a few bars of music.
Because you do a lot of spoken word performance.
I was an old guy before anyone ever invited me to do any, but and I don't do really a lot because I'm not part of the literary careerist scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not one of these guys that gets invited to read all the time. Another thing, I live in Belleville, which is not a hotbed of readings. But yeah. I have been on the West Coast within the last couple months reading poetry out there, and for this new book of mine, which is called The Big Thirst and Other Doggone Poems. So I read in Victoria, Vancouver, and the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, great.
It's rewarding. I used to think poetry didn't make as much money as fiction, but in a weird way, in this country, it does.
Which is nice to know, isn't it?
People are more willing to buy a poetry book than a prose book, a novel, I find.
Mm-hmm.
And you sell them there at your readings. And I'm putting aside the prose, although I do have a book of short stories coming out by a local publisher, Hidden Brook.
So you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's stories new and selected, going all the way back to the 70s. Covers different themes, different locales. Some are funny, some are sad, and I'm looking forward to it. But now I'm writing poetry.
Yeah. Any particular themes?
The universal ones. Love, death, music, sex.
All right.
Did I always say that loud enough? Sex? Travel?
Well, perhaps you could read
what
a
else
few
is
poems
there?
For us.
Okay. This poem is called Wooden Indians. Scattered in the long ago across North America, a great nation more numerous than Kiowa, Ottawa, Pawnee, Comanche, and never took to the warpath. Where did they go, those wooden Indians? In my childhood, an old deciduous one on Sycamore Street had stood shaggy and immobile through the siege of Petersburg, the big band era, and early Elvis. There was a big one at Fat Annie's Roadhouse and Pete Kelly's Blues. Some were famous, like poor old Kalijah, but most nameless old warriors who had buried the hatchet to stand all dignified out front of cigar stores. Where did they go? Maybe they were rounded up in the middle of the night and transported to thoroughly inappropriate camps like Geronimo sent to Florida to rot in the humidity? Were they shanghaied for figureheads on clipper ships? Maybe they were massacred by black plaster lawn jockeys. Somewhere there are wooden Indians in warehouses wrapped in termite blankets. They've even removed wooden Indians from museum dioramas where they hunted papier-mâché buffalo. I dream there's a lost nation still of wooden Indians. Many, I'm told, fled to Europe like jazz men. They get no respect. If a movie were ever made about wooden Indians, they'll probably be played by wooden Italians. They have no status, file no claims, yet most white people boast of having some Indian blood, usually Cherokee. But they don't invite them into their homes. Tell the truth. Would you let your daughter go out with a wooden Indian? Wouldn't you worry he'd always be hard? I heard the ones who remain are being forced to assimilate by marrying ventriloquist dummies. Be kind to the next wooden Indian you see, for after all, maybe he doesn't really have a wooden heart.
It's actually delightful. I like your sense of humor in there.
Sense of humor? It's not supposed to be funny.
Oh, yes. Another one?
Another one? Here's one on a different theme entirely. Guadalajara Night. A silver caravel the moon makes against the demerara dark sky and sea. Two blue mahus with truncated trunks flank a low barnacle wall bursting bougainvillea, and banana leaves like elephant's ears scratch my stingy brim. It's like a tourist painting, but all of them have gone, leaving only me, thinking of only you in this pre-revolutionary restaurant. Fluorescent tubes spread a cape of dim light over the sand. Two cops loiter at the hem of it, leaning against white beach loungers, stacked to look like porta-potties. Their talk sounds like Cuban machine gun fire, but the palm fronds might as well be whispering a windblown Ukrainian. They're in the lee of a Capac Cremona that might have been drawn by a tropical tot with a thick black Crayola. Now, if I hold a glass just so, the breeze ruffles the dark liquid and reflects the moon, that silver caravel that's taking me soon over Demerara sky and sea to you.
Thank you. And actually, that brings up your travel writing. You were a journalist in the past, and part of your immense output of books is travel writing and collections of short stories, and you're known for your adventurous spirit. Maybe tell us about a few of your travels and the writing that came out of them.
Well, one thing about the journalism is that it helped me finance trips that I otherwise would have had to pay for. You know, I used to just go to the Amazon or go to Vietnam. But then magazines, well, this is in the glory days. People, young journalists now don't believe it, but magazine would pay you to go. A freelancer, they'd pay to go somewhere. So I took advantage of that, and on journalism assignments, I did go to the Amazon and to Asia and to South America and Central America and Mexico and Greenland even.
Wow.
And it was great fun. Sometimes I was retracing my steps. Other times I was going someplace I'd never been and financing my trip. Because we're long past the days when a guy or a woman could stow away on a freighter. You know?
Right.
That's all over.
And then have you turned any of those experiences into your short stories and things?
Well, I've written true stories. Mm-hmm. Stories about some of these trips and adventures that aren't really journalism. Because I go into things that maybe a journalism audience wouldn't be interested in. Relationships that would be extraneous to the coverage of the war. But short stories, well, sometimes they might be set in a foreign locale, but I don't like the notion that people have to depend on the locale to give the story any kind of meaning.
Yeah, it's really about people, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about the people, the relations. That should be primary, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Could you maybe finish off with one more poem?
Yeah. That last book of poetry, called A Big Thirst and Other Doggone Poems, takes its title from this, A Doggone Poem. It's got gnawed-on ears and might wag its tail, maybe give a paw if it has a mind to. Call it a stray dog of a poem, a doggone poem that looks like a cross between a chuck wagon and a wolverine. This poem helped a guide dog across the street and dared eat out of Rinty's bowl. He growls at the mailman and the cop on the beat, but children often ride on its back. And it never comes on all mysterious like a house cat of a poem. This one sleeps where and when it wants. Sure, it may be querulous and misshapen, but it has something most other poems don't have. It has something. Never attempt to put a leash on it, much less a muzzle. Some have tried and lost a finger or the seat of their pants. This poem is not licensed by the authorities. It likes to saunter along, going where it wishes, and watches the other poems in their enclosures. They can whine and preen and growl and bark all they want, knowing they're safe on that side of the fence.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time out to and read to us and tell us all about your work.
I've enjoyed it.
Where can listeners buy your books?
Well, I hate to say this, but I think the best place to buy them is online. And I think that it may be the case with most books by most Canadian authors.
And I know that your latest book of short stories is being put out by Hidden Brook Press, which is local to our area. So you can get that, I imagine, at the Hidden Brook Press website as well.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in today. If you want to connect with Felicity and me, please go to our email, wordonthehills897@gmail.com, or leave a comment at our website, www.wordonthehills.com. And that's where you'll also find all our programs archived, where you can listen to them anytime and anywhere. Thanks for tuning in. We'll hope you'll join us for another program next week, Sunday, 1 p.m., Word on the Hills, on Northumberland 897, truly local radio.